Welcome to Planetary Conversations. I'm your host, Warren Bell. Each week I talk with experienced and knowledgeable guests from all backgrounds and walks of life as we explore ideas and actions that can restore the health of our planet and heal our relations with one another. Check out our website at voiceoftheshoeshop.ca, and you can find all our episodes on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen, ancestral, and unceded lands of the Suquamish people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbours. Mining is a messy business. It's responsible for about 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions, the cause of the steadily rising temperature of our planet Earth. Mines produce tailings, huge accumulations of sand, rocks, chemical byproducts, polluted water, and other materials that contaminate soil and waterways for many decades. Open pit mines, found throughout the world, destroy large areas of prime natural ecosystems. And the mining industry has an unenviable track record in countries in the global south, and in Canada too, of trampling on human and civil rights, and receives accusations of injuring and even killing local and Indigenous protesters. At the same time, the mine industry produces steel, aluminum, lithium, gold, and rare earth metals that are critical for computer chips, solar panels, and 101 other industrial and domestic uses. And then there's coal and potash. Love it or hate it, the mining industry today is integral to societies in every part of the world. Our guest today is Jamie Neen. Jamie is Outreach Coordinator and Canada Program Co-Lead for Mining Watch Canada, a watchdog organization that has monitored the behavior of the Canadian mining industry, trying to push it to become more environmentally and socially responsible. It's a tall task, but as you will learn, Jamie has a great deal of experience and a long history of advocacy for social and environmental justice. If anyone's up to this task, he certainly is. So Jamie, it's great to have you join us today on Planetary Conversations.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, your official position, as I mentioned, has a name that may be a difficult thing for people to interpret, but what exactly are you responsible for in Mining Watch Canada? What are your duties, as they say?
They come in a couple of different areas, and one is working with communities affected by mining in western and northern parts of the country. I have a colleague who works in Quebec in the east, based in Abitibi. And along with that comes working on mining policy and laws and regulations in those areas. So I'm also the co-chair of the BC Mining Law Reform Network, which I encourage people to look up online, where we're trying to work with and push the provincial government to reform, as it says, BC mining laws and things like the Mineral Tenure Act, which really come out of the Gold Rush era and have not been meaningfully fixed since then. You know, so things that are not even constitutional according to Canadian courts, like allowing mining claims to be established on people's land without even notifying them, much less consultation and consent for First Nations, mine waste safety, that kind of thing. And the other aspect is sort of the overarching, outreach communications and really policy work nationally and internationally, trying to, you know, as you said in the introduction, make the mining industry accountable, but on a more national and global level. So working on everything from environmental impact assessment laws and processes nationally, federally that is, to economic measures, to, you know, like trying to restrict the tax benefits and subsidies that mining companies enjoy, which basically funnel taxpayer money into investors' pockets. Yeah. And then things like trying to actually find ways to bring some sense of accountability and control to the Canadian mining industry globally, where the Canadian government and Canadian mining corporations are active all over the world, especially in Latin America, but everywhere.
And Africa,
you know,
as well.
With very little, exactly. With no restrictions and very little, if any, accountability whatsoever.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Now, you've worked also fairly extensively with Indigenous peoples in Canada, initially with the Dene Cree, the Lubicon. Is there something in common between the way peoples in far away from Canada, as countries in Latin America, countries in Africa, are treated in the way we have in Canada related to our Indigenous cousins and friends and neighbors? Have we done the same, has the industry rather done the same thing to them in Canada as has been done in other parts of the world?
Yeah, it has everything in common. We're basically looking at the same colonial extractivist policies, you know, in Canada, all over the place, as they apply in, you know, parts of Africa, in Latin America, and so on. Because the logic is the same. The logic is that the state, the government, controls these resources, regardless of how they were acquired, and you know, the doctrine of discovery comes into play there, where, you know, the government says it owns these things because it owns these things. It's a bit of a tautology. It's ours because we say it's ours. You know, and then works with the mining industry to extract wealth from those properties. You know, and they may give some benefit, some crumbs to, you know, local communities and so on. They may engage with local politicians and work with local contractors and so on, and you know, provide the lower skilled jobs locally and so on. But the pattern is the same, and the pattern is one of extracting that wealth and centralizing it for the benefit of the investors, whoever those are.
Yes, the shareholders yeah, that have no interest in or knowledge of what's going on in the business that they are buying shares from, typically. Now, I want to touch briefly on something that's completely different in a way, and that is, when I went to the website, it was clear that most, 5 out of 7 of the core staff with Mining Watch Canada are women. Now, that's been a change that's taken place within other organizations, especially organizations looking at transformative change. Could you just talk about that a little bit? Has that been something that's changed, that women have come forward more and been accepted more into positions of leadership?
Well, I mean, for Mining Watch, it's always been the case. Our board and staff have always been mostly women. And, you know, I think there's a strong element of feminist analysis, by which I mean liberatory feminism, not, you know, corporate feminism.
Sure.
That goes into things like community organizing and participatory action research and decision-making processes that are not top down, that are not centralized, but are shared, and where there are, you know, fundamental aspects of mutual respect and recognition that go into decision making and how we, you know, how we work internally, but also how we work with partners and community groups and so on. Which is recognizing that everyone comes to the table with their own experience, their own knowledge, and we engage and learn from each other. And that's how we build the future.
Let's get back a little bit to talking about the Canadian mining industry in particular. It's sort of a big deal in the mining world around on planet Earth. The largest producer of potash, the second largest producer of uranium, major producer of gold, nickel, platinum, $47 billion in revenue. I did a little research here. 50% of the world's mining companies are headquartered in Canada, which is news that I wasn't aware of. And 80% of the industry's share of trading of shares takes place on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So in a certain sense, Mining Watch Canada is really Mining Watch globally, almost implicitly. Would that be fair to say?
In a way, there is some competition with, you know, Australia and other jurisdictions in terms of who can get out there and get the mining happening. And Canada has lost a lot of ground in the top echelons of the industry over the last couple of decades. So Alcan, Inco, Falconbridge, Noranda, you know, these were the big names in mining globally, and they're now part of other, you know, major global companies that are, you know, based in Switzerland and Australia and England. So, you know, we've lost that, a lot of that level of operations. Mining is still significant in Canada, regionally at least. I mean, nationally, you know, those numbers are big. The gross production and export value are large, but the contribution to GDP is really you know, less than 4%. It's focused in specific parts of the country where mining is a big activity. You know, southern BC, northern Ontario, and Quebec, and so on. Those are the sort of the major centers. What we have is, as you said, a lot of finance going on, a lot of political engagement, and a lot of smaller mining companies that are active all over the world. And the other curious thing is that gold is really important. So something that is not actually useful, that has a very limited industrial use, you know, there's a few micrograms of gold in your phone and so on, but it doesn't add up to anything more than, I think the World Gold Council is saying now, 8% of global gold production. And of course, there are thousands of tons of gold already sitting in the vaults doing nothing at all. But that is Canada's most important mined product. Not copper, not coal, not uranium, not potash. Obviously, there's a whole lot more potash produced than gold, but it's not worth more.
Sure.
And so, you know, a lot of the mines in Canada are gold mines, and a lot of the mining companies that are active across Canada and globally are gold, focused on gold. And, you know, with the price of gold, you know, getting to $5,000 an ounce, that is just getting worse. You know, the attraction is fairly obvious.
Indeed. Well, I suspect corporations, that's their sine qua non. Where's the profit lie? Now, not only is Canadian mining industry in a somewhat modified form now, still a major player, but also, of course, it has a reputational aspect to it. I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, how the Canadian mining industry has been viewed, first of all, by the rest of the industry, but also by society at large in countries outside Canada. What sort of shadow does it cast?
Yeah, it's a bit of a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde scenario in a way, because, you know, the Canadian government and Canadian companies go out into the world telling everyone about how great Canada is and how well we do things and so on. You know, trading on the image of the Mounties, being, you know, these nice guys on horses, not the guys that attack Indigenous protesters, but the ones who, you know, get their man and ride really nice horses. But, you know, this is the image that we bring forward. And it's sort of the Canada as the global Boy Scout, you know, the UN peacekeepers, which we used to be part of, don't do very much anymore. And, you know, that sort of, well, whatever's going on, it's okay because it's Canadians doing it and they're nice. Mm-hmm. And that has fallen apart over the last few decades and in many parts of the world, largely just because of the mining industry. So we've, you know, had firsthand accounts of people traveling in places like Guatemala, hiding the Canadian patch on their backpack because they didn't want to be identified as Canadian because of what the Canadian mining companies were doing locally. You know, they really didn't want to be taken off the bus and beaten up by being identified as Canadian. You know, where Canadian companies were involved in forcibly building, you know, mining installations, you know, with the army and local police backing them up, evicting people from their own land, you know, destroying communal lands and forests and pastures and so on. And this getting into sort of the local awareness of things that say, oh, Canadians are not nice at all. And you don't really want to have to explain that you're not part of the you're not involved with the mining company, you're not part of this operation, because that, you know, that might take too long to explain. And, you know, and there is a basis for this, and it's not just, you know, it's not necessarily that Canadian mining companies are worse than American or British or Australian companies. Sometimes they are, but just there are so many of them, and the dynamics of the industry are such that, you know, odds are, and research has shown this, that that is going to be Canadian companies that are identified as the protagonists here.
Our guest today is Jamie Neen. Jamie is Outreach Coordinator and Canada Program Co-Lead for Mining Watch Canada, a watchdog organization that has monitored the behavior of the Canadian mining industry, trying to push it to become more environmentally and socially responsible. What I've heard is that the mining industry and its structure and the federal government's relationship to it as an industry that exports and imports broadly, is that it's been given a bit of a green light outside Canada as well as inside Canada. Now, everybody's probably in Canada is familiar with Mount Pauley, the worst environmental disaster in British Columbia's history by most accounts, which took nearly 10 years to reach the courts, and the BC government didn't even bother to mount some kind of penalty procedure against Mount Pauley. Is that because the same permissive attitude has existed in Canada as well, that, you know, you can get away with stuff overseas, Canadians don't see it, but the industry has the capacity to get away with things, or feels it can, within the boundaries of this country too?
Absolutely. There's a kind of impunity that, you know, mining companies enjoy in other parts of the world that they also do here. You know, and I won't pretend that the situation is as grievous in Canada as it is elsewhere. You know, people are not being killed and, you know, literally bulldozed out of their territories, out of their homes in Canada, to anything like the same extent that they're internationally. You know, obviously that does happen. All we have to do is look at the Unist'ot'en camp, and we see the RCMP and the bulldozers moving in. Indeed. Quite literally.
Armed to the teeth.
Or even Sun Peaks, for that mm-hmm. matter. Armed and violent. And, you know, so it's not something that we're not familiar with, you know, or the Kitchen McSibbananawig, chief and council being thrown in jail in Ontario for opposing an exploration project in their territory with that, you know, that they had not consented to.
Yeah.
So, but we do have a very lax regulation and enforcement in Canada. And sometimes we've got great regulations that are just not enforced. And sometimes the regulations themselves are weak. But, you know, for BC government officials to go around telling everybody that we have the best mining regulations in the world is simply not true. You know, other countries have at least as good and occasionally better regulations in many areas. So, you know, Brazil's response to mining disasters, and they had some that were, you know, much more deadly than Mount Pauley, but they revamped their regulations, and British Columbia did not.
Yes.
And so, you know, you look at that and say, well, what's going on here? And, you know, and fines and charges went ahead in Brazil and nothing happened in BC. And, you know, so again, both in the actual regulations and the enforcement, we can't really pretend that we're doing that well, or we shouldn't be. And, you know, if we're promoting Canada and BC as mining jurisdictions and destinations for mining investment, then we need to really up our game in terms of those regulations and enforcements to make sure that we really are doing it better and not, you know, not relying on industry self-regulation.
Speaking of this kind of behavior by the mining industry, I wonder if we could focus a little bit on relations between the industry and Indigenous peoples, not just in Canada. You've had some direct experience there and experience overseas as well. But overall, because Indigenous people are land protectors in many settings, they're associated with land that's been set aside from development in many parts of the world. Do you see a pattern of more marginalization or Indigenous peoples being more targeted, as it were, by the mining industry just because of the role they play in setting aside land from the sort of extractivism you mentioned earlier?
Yes and no. I would say that, you know, on some level, it's just a result of where Indigenous peoples are. And as the industry expands, it's going to continue to go into more remote areas. It's going to continue to go into more sensitive ecosystems, and it's going to continue to go into Indigenous territories because, you know, the prime farmland has been cleared of Indigenous people in large part. And, you know, over the past century, people were sort of left with what was considered to be less valuable land. And now that's, you know, showing up to be actually where there might be valuable mineral deposits and therefore, you know, a site of interest for the industry. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's just the nature of this, of the industry expanding and, you know, using up the most easily accessible resources and then moving out into more remote areas. But at the same time, if you look at, you know, the industry's response to the recent court case in Kakatla and Ahadasat, where, you know, the BC Court of Appeals had found that, in fact, the UN Declaration and the Provincial Declaration Act were enforceable and had been violated, and that mining tenures could not be granted in BC without consent of First Nations. The industry's response was pretty vociferous in calling this a, you know, a fount of uncertainty and so on, which, you know, I find really funny because we've been promoting this as the as a way of creating certainty. Say, well, you know, if you set up protocols with the First Nations on their territories, then you know what you have to do. There's no lack of certainty there. And if people are saying, you know, what areas are off limits and what areas might be considered for mining, that provides you with certainty too. So you're not going in, as they currently do, staking everything and then finding out afterwards that nobody's going to ever let you mine there. That's uncertainty to me. But they, you know, they want to push back. So, you know, clearly there is a kind of targeted response saying, you know, opposing First Nations territorial rights in their own territories.
You know, it strikes me that what you're describing is a deep sense of entitlement, that the industry has had it so good, so easy for so long, that even a minimal request or demand or insistence upon recognizing the rights of people who stand in the way of mining development is considered an affront. I mean, most people wouldn't, they would say, okay, well, as you just said, well, let's have a negotiation. And the industry just hasn't had to put that in their minds as a necessity for so long that they just think they can bluster their way out of it.
I think that's accurate. I mean, you know, when the mining industry was really getting established globally and in North America, you know, mine workers suffered a lot. It's still a dangerous job. It's still hard work, and it's also come a long way in terms of safety and protection for workers. But that's because the workers organized mm-hmm. and forced the mine owners to recognize, you know, their protection. And it's been really uneven, and a lot of people have suffered and died and had long-term illnesses as a result, whether it's silicosis or asbestosis or just, you know, heart disease from working those conditions. But they do now have not ideal, but better protection. Mm-hmm. And that's because they were able to organize and force the mine owners to recognize them. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I think that's the stage we're at now with land rights, that, you know, the industry has to be forced to recognize those rights.
I want to talk a little bit about what you actually did, because you had some interesting experiences with Indigenous peoples. One of your first jobs after graduating from McGill in 1988 with a degree in ecology and biogeography was working with the Lubicon Cree around uranium mining. What was that like? You're leaving an academic world. You're going out into the workforce, and you land in this tumultuous situation where the Lubicon Cree are being exploited in very serious ways, and you're trying to act in the interface to try and ameliorate some of that. What was that like for you to land in that world?
So that was actually with the Hatchet Lake Dene Saint-Cliné in northern Saskatchewan. Yeah, I started working in northern Saskatchewan at Hatchet Lake in the communities Wollaston Lake in northeastern Saskatchewan, where the uranium mining industry had been established in the 1970s, and which is now, you know, the world's second top producing area of uranium. And, you know, and that was done without their consent. In fact, the elders told me that there'd been a meeting in about 1975 where what was then run by Shell, so representatives of Shell came to the community and said, you know, we're going to build this uranium mine, we're going to drain this lake, and we're going to do all these things. And the community basically said, no, go away, please. That didn't work, because construction started a few months later. And, you know, so it was very clearly without consent. And the issue there was well, that obviously, but also, you know, and people have been forced off their trap lines and family territories, you know, cabins and trap lines bulldozed and literally turned into open pit mines. The Rabbit Lake mine was Rabbit Lake, and it's now a pit full of radioactive tailings. But also just that they were trying to live with this situation and not getting adequate information. And so I walked in sort of saying, well, I don't speak Dene. I'm probably not going to learn very effectively. It's a really difficult language, but I can translate the stuff into English. And they were, you know, they would ask the government, the provincial government, the federal government, or the mining companies, are the fish safe to eat? Is the water safe in this location or that location? And they would get these environmental impact statements, you know, 3,000 pages of binders. Mm. They would get lengthy technical reports that, you know, no one could make any sense of. And so I said, well, look, I have a degree in this stuff. I can read it. I can interpret it into plain English. We can look at those issues and find out if those questions are even being answered. And if they're not, we can work on getting answers. And so, you know, I did that for a couple of years. And, you know, there was, I think, at the time, a fairly positive response from the industry and government as far as it went. And that was also propelled by the fact that there was a major spill in the middle of the time I was working there. It's sort of getting working on this, and suddenly there's a big spill at the mine, and suddenly there's some pressure on the company and the government agencies to respond. So, you know, it kind of went sideways after that, because we found that, you know, yes, there is now a provincial monitoring committee set up that allows people from the community to be part of this committee and visit the mine sites and so on. But it's run by the province, and it doesn't go where the committee members want to go or the community members want to go. It doesn't really answer their questions. So it ends up being more for show. And I think that is a really unfortunate story that is far too common.
As you were describing this situation and the inherent unfairness and injustice, shall we call it, that the Dene were subjected to, what did it feel like? You know, we'll get into your origin story a little bit, but what did it feel like to be seeing this happen? The entitled companies, the sort of officious government saying we can do what we want and we'll do something. And then there was a spill and that made them shape up a little bit. But otherwise they felt so entitled that, and you were caught in this pincer between the people who are being marginalized and the marginalizing forces. What sort of state of mind does that put a person into?
Well, it is a sense of the injustice of the situation. I mean, and I had put myself there to try and help do something about it.
Right.
You know, and obviously, you know, this is not a balanced power relationship. It's a very unequal situation where the people who should have the power in their own territory, who've lived there for thousands of years, mm-hmm. and will be there when the mines are gone and when the mining companies are gone and probably when the governments don't exist any longer either, you know, will be left with millions of tons of radioactive waste in their territory that they never asked for, but that they're now responsible for by dint of it being there, you know, and yes. and they're responsible for, you know, their territory and are left with this. So, yeah, I mean it's a pretty astonishing proposition, really, that people are able to come from outside and install this operation that will leave these wastes and leave this really quite profound hazard in the landscape essentially forever,
yes.
and walk away.
Our guest today is Jamie Neen. Jamie is Outreach Coordinator and Canada Program Co-Lead for Mining Watch Canada, a watchdog organization that has monitored the behavior of the Canadian mining industry, trying to push it to become more environmentally and socially responsible. Jamie, you all became involved with the Labrador Inuit and their land claim all around the James Bay hydroelectric project. That was also pretty monumental as an example of invading a place for something that was there that the invaders wanted. And you were also involved with language issues there and the translation. It was a little more complex there, but why don't you talk about language used by the invaders versus the language of the invaded and how that transition, that interface really needs to be bridged if there's any justice to be exercised.
Well, I'm not a linguist, but, you know, like I say, I've been working in English and in scientific jargon and trying to decipher that. I was working for the National Inuit Organization for several years, and part of that involved working with the interpreters and translators as on environmental issues in particular, because that's what we were working on. So around things like hydroelectric development or mining, and this is at the time when the Voisey's Bay mine was being developed or being proposed and then developed. And so, you know, it was an interesting part of that work was figuring out how do we talk about these things in Inuktitut.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, one of the interesting things of that is, you know, you've got a national Inuit organization, you've got a handful of Inuit dialects across the country, and you've got interpreters and translators coming from the communities working with their own language to try and find ways to describe terms and things and concepts that are completely alien in ways that people can make sense of them. And it's, you know, with a lot of success, you know, they're really good at what they do and they're able to find ways and, you know, and sometimes it's a bit of an explanation, like you can't just come up with a word that makes sense. But, you know, it's a really interesting process to be part of, and finding ways to talk about things like persistent pollutants or radioactive pollutants that are, you know, not what people are used to. You know, if you come from a society where things come from the land and go back to the land, or come from the water and so on, the idea that you have contaminants that will be in the environment and will be a hazard for different periods of time, some forever, that will affect different parts of the body and so on, that's, you know, those are things that you have to figure out how to describe, and it's quite fascinating.
When you were figuring that out and then conveying these notions that there will be something left behind that will be poisonous and will harm you for time immemorial, the phrase that's often used by Indigenous people around the world for saying how long they've been where they are, what kind of reaction, you know, emotional reaction or just response, gut response, did you see among Inuit and the Dene and others when they get this news? They get this news front and center, they in language they can understand.
Well, some of it is actually, I think, a relief, because in many cases people have been having health effects. They know that something's dangerous. They, you know, they come in contact with something, and you know, you get a rash or some skin effect, or over time people develop, you know, different physical responses to contaminants. And to some extent, it's kind of a relief to make sense of it, to say, okay, now we know what happened. You know, everything from miscarriages to lung disease and so on.
Various, like, cancers.
Okay, there's an explanation for this. Mm-hmm. It's not happy. It's not great news, but at least it makes sense. Mm. And, you know, the other response I think is just one of, based on experience with colonialism, that, you know, these people come from outside and they do things that can be helpful. They bring things that can be helpful that are useful. They also cause a lot of harm, and there they go again. You know, and it's, you know, you might expect more kind of open anger and resentment. And I won't say that there isn't anger and resentment, or that it's undeserved, but you know, I think in a sense people are almost in some way inured to that kind of imposition, that it's like, oh crap, there they go.
Mm. I noticed one thing that I noticed reading on about the Inuit and their response to various intrusions was that in 2001 they changed the name of Inuit Teparisat, which I believe means Inuit will be united. They changed it in 2001 to Inuit Tepariat Kanatami. Pardon my, I hope there's nobody who's Inuit speaking, Inuktitut speaking, listening to this show. Which means Inuit are united in Canada. Do you want to talk a little bit about, with regard to what we're just talking about now, what that represents? It sounds like it represents a sense of cohesion and unified response against some of these intrusions and invasions and impositions, like focusing the anger in constructive response.
Well, all of the Inuit regions now have completed comprehensive land claims agreements with the Government of Canada. So with the Labrador Inuit land claim, you know, establishing Nunatsiavut and the Nunatsiavut government, you know, all of Inuit Nunangat, which is the Inuit homeland, is now governed under an agreement with, or under a series of agreements with Canada. So that kind of job was done. You know, the initial purpose of this organization had been fulfilled, and they were moving to a different phase.
Yes. You had some dealings with the federal government, and particularly with one of the MPs in the area, Ray Epp. Why don't you talk about him and the way the federal government addresses these issues itself?
So Ray was the NDP Member of Parliament for Northern Saskatchewan, for north of Prince Albert. And so he was there in 1989, when that spill happened in Wollaston Lake, he was a member of parliament, and I ended up working in his office for several weeks, helping him respond to the media, to community inquiries, and so on, and just trying to understand what had happened and what could be done about it. And, you know, got to know some really good people in that process. But he was interesting because his background was in community development, and he went back into community development when he left politics. Mm. So, you know, his orientation was really not towards mega projects or wheeling and dealing or, you know, working for some law firm, making deals with somebody, but actually just working with community groups and municipalities and First Nations on what would work for them. And so, you know, that was a really interesting kind of exposure. He also had this amazing politician's memory where he could get in a taxi cab from the airport in Ottawa and, you know, realize it's the same cabbie that he had 6 months ago and say, you know, so how's your wife's health? She was having some, you know, issues last time we talked. What's going on with that? And being able to remember names and histories like that, which is, I think, a huge asset if you're in politics.
It's, you know, probably a huge asset anywhere, way. I would say. Yes.
Quite a remarkable skill.
Now, formally, Mining Watch Canada was founded in 1999. What struck me was that there were two issues that seemed to bring it forward in people's minds. One was Tetsin Shini in British Columbia, in the topmost, on the Mercator projection, the topmost left-hand part of the province, right on the border. And then this growth in the mining industry overall. What was that specific project around Tetsin Shini? What was Mining Watch's role in that 2 year process?
So Mining Watch actually sort of came about as a result of that. So this was a struggle that was sort of led in a way by the Western Canada Wilderness Committee. But really, you know, conservation groups across BC and nationally started getting involved because this is, you know, a glacial area in the, you know, headwaters of important rivers and sensitive ecosystems and so on, that if we're going to protect any, you know, sort of so-called pristine part of the country, that would be it. And, you know, and the idea that mining would go ahead and destroy the glaciers and imperil the watersheds and the salmon runs and the grizzly bears and everything else, people kind of freaked out. So, you know, I mean, and so it was a huge battle because obviously the province was ready to go ahead with it and the industry was pushing forwards. But as a result of that, I think environmental groups across the country realized that we didn't really understand the mining industry very much. And that was just one big battle. And there were lots of others. There were projects being proposed and brought into different parts of the country that posed all kinds of really serious challenges to local environments and watersheds. And we really needed to have a better way to respond to that, both, you know, in the moment where these proposals come forward and people need access to information and capacity and expertise to respond, you know, within the regulatory process, but also more in terms of public organizing and political action. But then trying to change the rules of the game so that these things don't just keep happening and come out of the blue, and we don't have to keep fighting the same battles over and over again. And, you know, so that was a big part of it. And then, as you say, there were probably a couple of other pressures that were coming together. And one was the expansion through the 1990s of the Canadian mining industry globally, as part of the economic globalization that was going on, really starting in the late 1980s, but really picking up through the 1990s globally and you know, in terms of mining, especially in Latin America. And then, you know, as I mentioned, the Labrador Inuit land claim was underway, but there's also lots of indigenous land-related title claims, land claims, and so on being brought forward, and conflicts emerging around mining in particular, where the mining industry was trying to move into indigenous territories, sometimes with a, you know, under a negotiated agreement and with everything on the table, but often just, you know, applying pressure and relying on government permits to say, hey, you know, we're legally allowed to do this, get out of the way.
Our guest today is Jamie Neen. Jamie is Outreach Coordinator and Canada Program Co-Lead for Mining Watch Canada, a watchdog organization that has monitored the behavior of the Canadian mining industry, trying to push it to become more environmentally and socially responsible. To which comment, I would ask you a question about what industry has done in recent years to, I don't know if it's greenwashing or if it's a genuine attempt to change, but there's this document, which I had a brief look at, called Towards Sustainable Mining. Now, industries have done things like this before, the oil and gas industry, other extractive industries. I'm sure you're familiar with this document. What do you see it as with your level of knowledge and expertise?
So this is a industry attempt at self-regulation, you know, and there are a number of these around the world. They're now working, the industry is now working on a unified sort of set of standards for itself. And, you know, the problem with this, as with any sort of self-regulation, is that it is not accountable. You know, the enforcement mechanism there is that in order to be a member of the Mining Association of Canada, you have to apply these standards. If you don't, well, you can leave. And in fact, you know, the Mining Association of Canada does not represent most of the mining companies in the country.
After this document came out, did people leave the Mining Association of Canada saying, well, I don't want to get pinned down by that sort of stuff?
Well, interestingly, you know, none of this is attributable, but Taseko Mines, who have been fighting the Chilcotin people over their you know, prosperity, and then the new prosperity mine in Saint-Louis and in Fish Lake in the interior, was suddenly no longer a member of the Mining Association. So, you know, we can't say what happened there. We can only make that observation. And, you know, it took until last year for the Chilcotin to reach an agreement with Taseko to recognize their authority over their own territory long after the Supreme Court of Canada already had, which is another, you know, another famous case where the Chilcotin gained that title recognition based on having occupied and defended their territory from mining and so on for a century.
Indeed.
But which the Supreme Court had to recognize. So, I mean, I look at it two ways. And one is that, you know, it's sometimes it's being sold as a way of trying to persuade governments that they don't have to bother regulating, that we can look after this ourselves. It's a form of greenwashing. You sell it to the public. You say, look, everything's fine. We've got these wonderful standards in place, you know, responsible mining, blah, blah, blah. And it undermines regulation even more than, you know, the provincial government already has. So, and it's also being presented and promoted internationally, again, sort of as a substitute for regulation.
Yes.
If the industry does this, then you don't have to bother regulating. And you know, my response to that is that, you know, well, obviously we still need regulation, because you're only looking at the best case scenarios. It's promoting best practices, which is a great thing to do. And, you know, I do think it's very useful for the industry to work on best practices and this kind of guideline that says, here's how things should work. If you're doing things right, this is how to do it. It's very process oriented. It's not results based. It's what comes out of the end of the pipe doesn't matter in the same way, as long as the way you build the pipe and everything is proper. This is a problem with other standards I'm sure you're familiar with.
Very much so.
But, you need both. And it's great to have best practices being developed and promoted, but we need to stop the worst practices. We need to stop the people who are willing to do whatever it takes to get what they want. We need the people who are, willing to undermine local governments and First Nations and ignore the law and violate the regulations. They need to be brought under control.
Yeah, the difference between promoting good practices and enforcing good practices is a very important difference. And I think you've just highlighted how it's great to say this is what we should be doing and what we think we will do, but not saying if we don't do it, there'll be any problem. Saying, well, if you can just leave the organization if you want to. Now, before we go, I want to just talk a little bit about your origin story, because it does imply, when listeners hear it, that you were destined to do something like this in some ways. Your father was Brewster Neen. He was born in the States in Ohio, and your mother was Kathleen Neen, and she was born in England. She was Jewish. He was a Protestant minister, and they met through involvement in the campaign for nuclear disarmament. He got married, moved to Toronto, and there got involved in all sorts of advocacy issues, including opposing nuclear weapons, food systems, liberation theology, socialist politics. And you can see that narrow sectarian thinking is really off the table almost from the get-go. But then in order to, as it was stated, see food systems from the farmer's side, they moved in 1971 to Nova Scotia and bought an 80-acre sheep farm, which at its full size had 700 sheep, you told me. At age 12, you started up an Oxfam group in I guess you must have been about grade 6 at that time. The apple not falling far from the tree. What was it like growing up in this family where your parents were both deeply involved with advocacy and verbal, and I'm just imagining the soundtrack for conversations over the dinner table instead of, what did you do in school today? It would be like, what are we going to do about this? Why don't you just paint that picture a little bit of what your growing up scenario was like?
There's a couple different sides. So one is that it was kind of, in a way, it was kind of isolated because, I wasn't playing junior hockey with the guys from school and all that kind of thing. We were busy farming and didn't have time or money for that kind of thing. But it was also very, what's the opposite of isolating? Very integrating, very, very connected, because we had visitors from all over the world coming and, coming on tour with, whether it was the Oxfam local committee or some church group or something. These networks that existed and still exist, bring people from communities and struggles around the world to talk about what they're going through and to build solidarity and networks of support. And so that was very, empowering is not really the word, but really connecting and making those links was really a big part of what was going on. And of course, at the same time, Kathleen and Bruce were both involved in the sheep farming business and working with sheep farmers and the Sheep Producers Association of Nova Scotia, and eventually creating the Northumberland Lamb Marketing Cooperative, which still exists and still functions, to help sheep farmers make a better living, mm-hmm. and develop better practices and share experiences and learn from each other and build a better build better farms. So, you know, and what I learned from that about, you know, about organizing, about, you know, how to get people together, how to see past the differences and look at common projects and common common intentions and common problems and really, you know, as we started off talking about, looking at people as the experts in their own lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, and Kathleen was very involved in the women's movement, locally and, you know, and intellectually as well. So, you know, that was very much part of that kind of formation. And, you know, coming out of that, I think in a way it's kind of funny, but, you know, in what was it, 1979, 80, there was uranium mining being proposed for central Nova Scotia. And we protested. And, you know, people like the young Elizabeth May were involved as well at the time. And, you know, there was a whole huge campaign across Nova Scotia to ban uranium mining, that you know, we... Nova Scotia is not very big, and it has very limited, you know, precious watersheds, and mining uranium is not something that we wanted, that could be done safely in that setting. And so ultimately it was banned, and that ban lasted until last year when the new Conservative government in Nova Scotia, you know, opened the doors to uranium mining and fracking and everything else that they could think of. They're basically trying to sell whatever's left of the family silver, but, you know, but that was a huge campaign. And, you know, and when I look back, it's like, oh yeah, there's a connection there that goes right through to where I am now.
You said something, Jamie, that I think is really germane. And that is that there was a certain amount of isolation from the daily workings of a small community in Nova Scotia. And instead of that, you were exposed to this ferment of ideas and actions that changed the structures of society, not just saying, okay, everybody plays hockey, so I'll play hockey, or everybody reads this, so I'll read this. So there is an isolation involved, and a certain, you might call it a sacrifice. You guys also had to work like slaves on the sheep farm. And so there were other commitments that you had. But really, there are many people around the world who have achieved great fame and acclaim because they worked really hard on a project that was not, you know, making sure that they had, you know, nice furniture in their front room, but trying to make the world a better place. And I'm just going to close with this quote, which was on a memorial page for your parents. Your mom died in 2016. And your father died less than 2 months ago in his early 90s, and I know that's been a very significant loss for you and your sister. But this is the quotation. What really comes through in their work is a commitment to building a better world, one where social justice and community are central, and where profit is driven from the room in a hail of stale bread, which is then picked up and used for pig food. The humor and the underlying serious light and lighthearted tone of that seems to me something that is a legacy that you have taken on and shaped you, but in your own way, doing your own version of what needs to be done to make the world a better place. I hope you continue doing this for a long time, Jamie. It's been a pleasure having you with us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Warren.